Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Checking Valley traffic, a pair of problems on the 60. Westbound at Alma School, the right lane is blocked by an accident. Also on the 60 westbound, an accident at Gilbert Road blocks the intersection. It'll be partly sunny for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high temperature of 73 degrees, right around average for today. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight. Overnight lows in the lower 50s. Sunny and warming up to 79 degrees by tomorrow. It's 65 degrees right now. Mexico has extradited an accused ringleader of the Sinaloa cartel to face charges in Southern California. Michel Morisco reports from KJZZ.
Victor Cáceres Castellón faces conspiracy and money laundering charges in San Diego. Mexico extradited Cáceres late last week, 4 years after his arrest. He was indicted after a 2007 drug enforcement investigation in California's fertile Imperial Valley. Cáceres is accused of trafficking more than 40 tons of cocaine into the U.S. He is the latest in a string of high-level extraditions of drug traffickers sent to the U.S. to face charges here. Michel Marisco, KJZZ News, Tucson.
Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich says the U.S. Supreme Court has cleared the way for distribution of more than $8.5 million to Arizonans who paid artificially inflated prices for electronic books. The high court rejected an appeal from Apple and left in place a ruling that the company conspired with publishers to raise ebook prices. Brnovich says $400 million will be refunded to consumers nationwide. A federal jury decided yesterday that two polygamous towns on the Arizona-Utah border discriminated against residents who were not members of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The verdict caps a 7-week trial in Phoenix federal court, but there's still a lot more to come in this case. I'm joined by KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Hi, Jude.
Hi, Mark.
So what exactly did the jury decide yesterday?
So the jury sided with the U.S. Justice Department on every count. The Justice Department brought this case. The jury determined Colorado City, Hilldale, and their water company violated the Fair Housing Act by discriminating against FLDS church outsiders and denying them services. And we had heard testimony in this case about FLDS church outsiders being denied housing, utilities, police protection. The jury also made an advisory finding that the local police department engaged in unconstitutional policing and failed to observe a separation between church and state. Ultimately, the final ruling on that count will be up to the judge, though.
So, Jude, what about the damages in this case? It sounds like some individuals who live in Colorado City and Hilldale will be getting money as a result of this?
That's right. So the jury initially awarded $2.2 million in damages to six individuals who testified in the case about emotional distress they felt from religious discrimination. But in fact, while the jury was deliberating, the two sides actually reached a partial settlement yesterday. The towns basically wanted to protect themselves from the possibility of a really high monetary payout. So they agreed to pay the federal government $1.6 million to give people who'd experienced emotional distress damages. Now the federal government can decide how to allocate that $1.6 million however they choose.
Despite yesterday's jury decision, this case is hardly over. What's next?
So now that the Justice Department won, this now heads into a second phase. So the judge will decide what kind of remedies and reforms are necessary in these two towns. And that could take months still to sort out.
What kinds of reforms could the Justice Department ask for?
So there's a whole range of things. So the Justice Department could ask the judge to put the two towns in receivership, could put in place a federal monitor to ensure there's no discrimination, or disband the local police department known as the Marshal's Office. Over the course of the trial, I asked various people who live in these towns who say they've felt discrimination what kinds of reforms they would like to see. One person I asked is Ginger Cook. She was never part of the FLDS church, and when she moved to Colorado City, she and her husband were denied a water connection and sewer connection for years. They experienced all kinds of harassment. She had to haul her own water and raw sewage. So she actually won an earlier lawsuit against the towns, but she says there's still big problems. And I asked her what needs to change.
you can't be an FLDS member and be a police officer. It's literally like when you take your vow, you're lying when you take the vow, because you are not going to be loyal to the citizens. You're going to be loyal to, right now, it's a pedophile that's sitting in prison, Warren Jeff. So I don't think that they should be allowed to be police, and I think that the city needs a receiver to be taken over by people who won't discriminate.
And what I think Ginger Cook's comment shows us is just how complicated this could be to sort out, since she feels like there won't be fair policing for non-church members if the cops belong to the FLDS religion. But at the same time, it could be a different kind of religious discrimination if all FLDS church members are banned from holding certain positions.
Lots of interesting questions to sort out. We'll keep following them as this case progresses. That's KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
Arizona lawmakers have sent Governor Doug Ducey a bill that would require the State Board of Education to develop a menu of options from which districts could choose alternatives to the AZ merit test. This was after the Senate defeated a proposal to allow parents to opt their kids out of the assessment. The Arizona School Boards Association is one of the groups in support of the bill that was ultimately approved. Heidi Vega is its director of communications, and she joins me. Heidi, why do you think it's a good idea for districts to have a menu of options besides AZ merit to assess students?
First of all, ASB supports local control, which is supporting the member districts, 225 districts in the state of Arizona. So, of course, we support creating local flexibility for each district. And so what that means is each district has their own way of conducting business top down. And so we support whatever strategies work for a school district and for the schools. Second is reducing testing burdens for not only students, not only teachers, but also for parents. So that's a 3-in-1, and we feel like that is a good thing. Third, this bill can also help assess how students are doing in fewer test days. A good example would be taking the ACT test. And so that is one example of how we could minimize an additional test and an additional assessment, which would be AZ merit, if the ACT would be on the menu of options that the State Board of Education could provide as another assessment that could essentially replace AZ merit.
Using that example, though, it costs money to take the ACT, and not all students do it. Would this be potentially an extra cost to districts if they don't want to give AZ merit, that they have to pay for a student to take the ACT?
No, that's just one prime example of how many school districts, many high schools, a lot of high schools I know with Phoenix Union, Helios, they partner up and they provide students with the opportunity to take the ACT test for free. But again, that's just one menu of options that the State Board of Education will probably provide as essential options of an assessment. But it will be essentially up to the State Board of Education providing the list of options that the school districts can choose from.
You mentioned that this is maybe a more efficient way of finding out how students are doing. I'm curious, if they're not all taking the same test, how do you find out, really, how do you compare district to district?
Well, so there are going to be a variety of different qualifications when it comes to this bill. And so one of them being that any assessment that would essentially be on that list would have to meet the college and readiness standards.
So they're testing the same standards, even if it's not the exact same exam that the students are taking?
Exactly, yes.
Do you have concerns that, I mean, the ACT is already an existing test. I mean, do you think that that is an appropriate one, or is that good enough to compare with those districts that will take AZ merit versus those maybe that will take the SAT or something else?
So when we compare the ACT to AZ merit, when we're looking at grades 9 through 12, that would be a fair assessment. Both of those assessments do meet these standards. Again, so that's one example of grades 9 through 12. There are a variety of different examples. There are different national assessments that other states do take that may be part of the list of options that the State Board of Education would provide. Again, we just have to wait and see what those options would be. But again, supporting local control and what's best for the school district at that local level.
ASBA did not support a similar kind of bill, which would basically have allowed parents to opt their students out of basically any testing, and ASBA did not support that bill. Why is it important, do you think, that students take some test, even if it's not necessarily AZ merit?
So it's important to at least benchmark, and that's what we do. We don't know. It's like a checkup, right? We don't know how to improve, how to make improvements, how to help that student do better if we don't know how they're assessing, what their strengths and what their weaknesses are. And so that not only impacts outside of the home with parents, but it also impacts inside the classroom with teachers. We need to provide teachers with benchmarks and help them identify what strategies they need to work on with individual children.
Heidi Vega with the Arizona School Boards Association. Heidi, thank you.
Thank you.
It's the show on KJZZ for Tuesday, March 8th. With the takeaways, Todd Zwillick today, I'm Mark Brody. 150 people were killed in U.S. airstrikes over the weekend in Somalia. The Pentagon says a drone hit an Al-Shabaab training camp where a large-scale attack was being planned. U.S. planes were also involved in that attack. The Pentagon also says it believes everyone killed in the strike were terrorist fighters. The Obama administration has relied heavily on the use of drones to take out what it claims are suspected terrorists. Lisa Monaco is the president's counterterrorism and homeland security advisor. She says the White House will now discuss annually how many people have been killed by U.S. drones since 2009, including civilians.
Not only is greater transparency the right thing to do, it is the best way to maintain the legitimacy of our counterterrorism actions and the broad support of our allies.
Now, it's important to note that the new policy will not cover active hostilities in places like Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. It only includes strikes in nations like Pakistan, Libya, Yemen, and, of course, Somalia. Joining me now is Michael Hayden. He was director of the National Security Agency from 1999 until 2005 and director of the CIA from 2006 until 2009. He has a new book out. It's called Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. General Hayden, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Todd. Happy to be here.
That strike in Somalia, 150 fighters killed, according to the Pentagon. Any strategic importance here or just another tactical gain in the war on terror?
No, it's an important tactical gain, but I think it's a tactical gain. It doesn't change the facts on the ground, but it makes us safer for the moment and actually creates some space so that policymakers can continue to do what they have to do eventually, which is to change the reality of the threat against us.
Now, we've learned in recent years about how the military and the CIA and the president himself go about choosing targets for drone strikes. What will we learn now from the new disclosures that Lisa Monaco and the White House is saying it's going to make on an annual basis?
Well, first of all, I was delighted that Lisa made that announcement. It's been hard for folks like me who actually have some real-world experience when it comes to the targeted killing program. It's been hard to try to justify the program in public since, frankly, we've been limited in what it is we can say about it. And so we have the claims made by the groups that you suggested are trying to follow this, which, frankly, the more extreme claims they make are not consistent with any of my life experience. But now we've got real numbers to put out there. Look, Todd, this is controversial. There aren't many governments who agree with our legal theory in terms of using targeted killings outside of the internationally agreed theaters of conflict. And so if we want legitimacy domestically and with our friends, we're just going to have to be more transparent about it.
There's a quote that's now getting kind of famous from you, General Hayden, in 2014 that says the reliance on air power has all the attraction of casual sex. It seems to offer gratification, but with very little commitment. And we need to be wary of a strategy that puts emphasis on air power and air power alone. Do you stand by that statement? And do these disclosures bring maybe a different calculation to how committed you are to the attraction of drone strikes?
Yeah, actually, that quote, it is an accurate quote, Todd, was directed specifically at our efforts against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And there, the nature of the problem is such that no one with any experience in these kinds of matters thinks that we can defeat ISIS with air power alone. This is a necessary, but I would admit, Todd, insufficient action on our part. My last week in government, I was on the margins of an NSC meeting. Rahm Emanuel, then the White House Chief of Staff, thanked me for something I had briefed on the margins of the meeting, an operational success. I said, Rahm, thank you very much. That's kind of you to congratulate us on that. But you realize, Rahm, if we don't change the facts on the ground, we get to kill these people forever. And my point being that that's not a successful strategy.
General Michael Hayden, part of your book tour the last couple of weeks has been going after Donald Trump for his rhetoric on the campaign trail, saying that he would bring back waterboarding, saying that he'd be willing to target the families of terrorists and other civilians. These things, of course, are war crimes and are illegal. You seem to have gotten to him. Donald Trump now says in his speeches that he has to stay within the law. But then I noticed kind of a wink and a nod to his raucous crowds that he's going to stay within the law, but ISIS doesn't stay within the law, so I'm going to do what I have to do.
Yeah, there's a lack of clarity. You had the, frankly, outrageous comments at the debate last Thursday. Look, Todd, my book's called Playing to the Edge. And so, frankly, I think I've had to defend myself against being very aggressive. But the title implies, in fact, it states that there is an edge, that there are limits. And some of the rhetoric coming out of Mr. Trump was well beyond any edge that a civilized nation should accept.
And still, you're acknowledging with your book title and your reference to it that there are edges you cannot cross. Maybe Donald Trump has, but there are millions of people who think that you crossed it long ago, and that President Obama did too.
Fully agreed. And that's the debate of a free people. So if we can just imagine a table in front of us, Todd, there are some things off here to one side that no one could possibly think would be acceptable. And there are some things over here on the other side that no one could argue against. And then you got most of the rest of the things you have as options. And those things are in what I try to describe in the book is an infinite gray zone in which you're trying to balance things, frankly, Todd, that are virtues, liberty, security, privacy, safety. But in the real world, you have to make choices. And how you balance what is the correct choice for that moment depends on the totality of circumstances in which you find yourself. And as a free people, we argue about that.
One also hopes that as Americans go out to presidential campaign rallies, regardless of which one they're going to, that they're getting at least some version of a nuanced view of this complex problem, regardless of whether they think Michael Hayden acted responsibly or not. Michael Hayden is former director of the National Security Agency and former director of the CIA. His new book is called Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. General Hayden, thanks again.
Thank you, Todd.
That's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway. Arizona has some of the strictest rules in place for public benefits, things like food stamps and cash assistance for needy families. Some advocates say they're seeing that lead to families selling their food stamps to pay for things like rent. We have two perspectives on this today, starting with Cynthia Zwick, Executive Director of Arizona Community Action Association. And Cynthia, is it common for families to be doing that?
No, in fact, it's very uncommon in this state. And I guess I would like to say first off, it's illegal to do it. But it's not very common at all.
Is it easier or harder, do you think, to be a low-income resident of Arizona than, you know, relative to other states?
I think it's getting harder and harder. And Arizona has the third highest poverty rate. We have a huge number of families who are struggling to make ends meet. And I think the story that you saw earlier is testament to that. People can't pay their utility bills. They can't pay their rent. They're having trouble purchasing food. The benefit for SNAP is very low, by the way. On average, it's about $120 a month.
SNAP is food stamps.
SNAP, exactly. So the benefit's fairly low.
And it's been getting a little bit lower, right? I mean, and the amount of time that residents can use these benefits has also been shrinking over time.
Well, I think you're talking about TANF. So the SNAP benefits have stayed fairly stable. They can, as long as they're eligible for them, they can continue to receive them. The amount that they receive has been in flux and is decreasing, and is insufficient, obviously. The Temporary Assistance to Needy Families benefit is a cash assistance program, and those are the ones that have gotten significantly shorter in duration.
And people who get that can use them for a wide variety of things. It's not specifically food. It could be rent. It could be utilities. It could be a lot of things. For people who get this amount of money and can only get it for a limited amount of time, what happens to those folks once that time runs out?
Well, it depends on the family, obviously, but some of those folks are relying more and more on nonprofits to make ends meet. They're relying on food banks to get food for their families. Some of them are becoming homeless. We know that that's happening. And some of them are under threat of becoming homeless and doing without.
As the state gets a little bit more money in its coffers, there are obviously a lot of competing priorities for how to spend that, whether you want to call it a surplus or not. And a lot of programs in state government were cut during the recession. Do you have any measure of optimism that some of these social service, social safety net programs will see any of that extra money that the state has?
Well, we're starting to see a little bit of progress. So I don't want to say it's sufficient, but we are starting to see some additional support for childcare. We are starting to see some support for foster grandparents that are raising their grandchildren. And we're starting to see some support for kids care at the state level. So hopefully that will be a beginning. There are small steps, and we're grateful for those small steps, but clearly much more needs to be done to support families in Arizona.
Cynthia Zwick is Executive Director of Arizona Community Action Association. For another perspective, we turn to Andrea Chavez. She's the Career Development Manager for Save the Family in Mesa. It provides housing and support services for low-income families. Andrea, what types of circumstances do your clients face?
A typical client right now is a single mom with a couple of children. They're typically coming in unemployed, and they're looking for opportunities to get back on their feet. Some of them are coming to us with absolutely no income, so we're deciding whether they need to get on state benefits or even if they qualify for state benefits at this point. Most of the families are coming in, and they're between the ages of 20 and 30, leaving domestic violence situations or other situations that just weren't healthy.
Do you find that you tend to see people before they apply for or receive state benefits?
More recently, I've seen a lot of our younger families, they've capped out of their benefits already. So although they're going to be changing their requirements again here in July, those families have already met their lifetime benefit, meaning they're showing up at our doors with no source of income or inability to get state assistance. So the push for employment is that much more important for that family.
For those families who have basically run out of state cash assistance, what do they do? Like, what kinds of choices are they having to make?
Well, if you think about the everyday expenses that you and I would have to pay, they're having to rely on agencies such as ours, and we're having to definitely increase the collaborations that we have. So, for instance, although a mom with one child might benefit from $100 to $200 in state benefits, if they're not able to get that, they're not able to pay the monthly phone bill, which hurts their chances of being heard from an employer. They might need to pay a registration fee of $50 to get their children registered in a child care center. But again, with no source of income, they're having to reach out to a bunch of different agencies that offer different services just to make ends meet, which isn't easy. There's a lot of red tape and paperwork to that type of thing. So imagine yourself in a situation where you can't pay your phone bill, but you're trying to even access these services just to figure out who can help.
How do you work with these families to help them prioritize if they have very finite financial support, how to spend it, what bills to pay, and what maybe they need to let go?
Well, we're very fortunate. Once they're in our program, they're assigned to work with the case manager. The case managers and the support staff here work together to help them figure it out. So they will typically meet with me, and we'll come up with a plan for employment, and I can offer referrals of where to get the phone bill paid. Save the Family offers a small amount of client needs money where maybe we could pay a $50 registration fee at a daycare center. But, you know, we're having to pull from different ends to make ends meet for the amount of families that we serve.
Do you find that you have enough money as an organization to help the families to the extent that you'd like to?
Oh, gosh, I think my immediate response to that is no. There's been a lot of limits to the type of funding that we're getting. There's been a lot of changes to that. And to meet the day-to-day needs that the families typically could have met receiving state assistance, we're having to pick up that as well, in addition to paying for all the needs that we offer as an agency.
Andrea Chavez is the Career Development Manager for Save the Family. For hunters, there are few really prized animals. The bighorn sheep is one of them. Here in Arizona, getting chosen for a chance to hunt one is rare and can cost up to $2,000. But as KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports, when a tag gets offered up to the highest bidder at a local fundraiser, that figure can grow exponentially.
The bidding for the Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep Tag started out at $5,000. The energy level in a banquet hall at a Scottsdale hotel is high and only intensified as the bidding started. There are only about 6,000 of the 200-pound animals in the state, and the opportunity to hunt one of the four types of bighorn sheep is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Literally, there is a lifetime limit.
I've been putting in for 26 years.
Rain Rush is a longtime hunter, but he's also a hunting guide with Sundowner Guide Service. Hunters who get one of these coveted tags pay him on average 10 grand on top of the money they spent at the auction to help them find, hunt, and harvest a bighorn sheep.
A lot of time before the hunt. We do a lot of scouting for months, all summer long. There's a lot of people involved in the sheep hunt. You may have 10 to 20 guys out looking.
Although most of the hard work is done in the months prior, the actual hunt is also physically challenging.
The rocky habitat, the high mountains, some of the units are roadless areas, so there's a lot of hiking involved just to get to where the sheep live.
The bidding has been steadily increasing. The last bid was $100,000.
Put your hands together, $100,110.
Amber Munich at the Arizona Game and Fish Department manages these big animals.
For some wildlife, hunting is a way of managing and controlling that population. For bighorn sheep, that's not the case. For bighorn sheep, hunting is providing a recreational opportunity.
Munich says only male rams are allowed to be hunted. In Arizona, most of the sheep are in three regions, the Black Mountains near Kingman, the Catalina Mountains near Tucson, and in the mountains near Yuma. She adds the money from the auction plays a huge role in maintaining the population.
The funding generated from the auctions, they're critical. Our bighorn sheep program relies almost solely on the funding from those auctions.
She explains the funds are used for conservation, translocation, and population counts. Speaking of money, the bidding at the auction is now up to $150,000. And there are just a handful of bidders left. And then there was one, Shane Roten, a resident of Fairbanks, Alaska, came in with the winning bid of $197,500, a price he says he was happy to pay for the possibility of a grand slam. In the hunting world, that's when one person harvests one animal from each subspecies. For Roten, this will be his last bighorn sheep. He adds he would have spent as much as it takes.
There's always a limit in your mind, but the reality is I live a pretty low-key lifestyle, and I'll spend as much on hunting as I do on any other aspect of my life.
That just shattered the record for that tag.
The state auctions off two of these special tags to the highest bidder. So far, this year, these auctions have brought in nearly $600,000 for conservation. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In a check of news from KJZZ, the Scottsdale Tourism Development Commission has vetoed an idea that would have given a group of gallery owners what some call veto power over certain special events. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports.
For more than 40 years, gallery owners have invited the public to stroll along the downtown arts district. The Scottsdale Art Walk, held every Thursday night, is marketed as America's original art walk. During Tuesday's tourism meeting, Scottsdale Gallery Association board member French Thompson told commission members they should be embracing the event.
The art walk is one of the things that made Scottsdale famous.
Its success attracted the Scottsdale Artisan Markets, a group that hosts outdoor events. And that didn't sit well with gallery owners. While they paid rent on their brick-and-mortar locations, the artisan markets paid less than $300 for a special events permit that allowed the group to reserve public land for a year and set up tents near Beverly Moore's Gallery.
Not only does it substantially affect my sales, but also it brings with it the huge parking issue that we have on the streets.
After getting complaints and petitions, the city stopped the events. The city council also directed staff to update the special events ordinance to ban any art-related events in the area on art walk nights. That didn't seem right to the city's own tourism commission, whose job is to make recommendations to the council. Here's member Carl Grupp.
Right now it reads to most of us that this very strong group in downtown Scottsdale could veto an event. And that seems inappropriate to most of us.
With a unanimous vote, the commission directed staff to return to the council and review the veto power of any special group. Christine Astis, KJZZ News, Scottsdale.
Are you curious about how many residential building permits Mesa has given out, or how about visitation to city-owned arts and cultural facilities? Well, you can now find the answers to those questions, plus many others. On Saturday, Mesa released a trove of data as part of its membership in the What Works Cities program. Ian Linson is Mayor John Giles' chief of staff, and he joins me. Ian, was this data the city was already collecting? Was it a lot of work to get this information ready to post online?
Yes to both those questions. So the city, in everything that we do, we gather a ton of data. And it's things as simple as transit ridership for light rail, traffic volumes at different intersections, code compliance cases, things like that. And so every department really had that more or less in silos. It was available sometimes online, sometimes in an internal document, but it was accessible. Now what we're doing is we're putting all of that information together in one place, making it very easy to be accessed, and then making it available to anybody to use for any purpose.
Who do you expect to be using this?
Really a whole host of people. I mean, we've heard stories from students getting a master's, need some of this information for a thesis, to really entrepreneurs who are looking to create that next app. They can use this data to kind of fuel and power that, to really internal city departments and employees. We constantly, when we're working on a project, it's not just one department that's involved, it's multiple departments. And so we need to request information from each other all the time. And, that might take a day or so as a staff member has to gather that and provide the information. Well, now for us, just as much as for the public, we can go to this website and pull the information ourselves in a fraction of the time.
How did the city decide which data sets to put online? Because frankly, some of them seem kind of esoteric. I was looking at some of them thinking, who on earth would possibly derive value from this?
That's funny you mentioned that. There was an incident. I spoke earlier about a master's student trying to complete their thesis. Well, there was some discussion about some water quality data and things like that, and a very similar question. Who would want access to that information? Well, there happened to be a student that was what they were looking for and would help them provide an answer to a question they were looking for, and so that would be valuable to them. But no, to get back to your original question, there was a couple different reasons for putting some of this data up now. And keep in mind, we hope to expand the data sets that are available. Right now we have 94 and definitely want to move that forward. But some of it was just ease of access, data that had already been cleaned and made very easily available so that we could put it up in a quick time frame. But then other data sets, what we did is we looked nationally and said, what data sets are being the most requested out there? And we kind of put together a top 10 list, and we pulled as many of those as possible that we had access to.
As you peruse through the numbers, have you seen anything that surprised you about your city?
Well, really what was fun for me is to be able to check out the traffic volumes at a lot of our different intersections. It's just amazing to see, we experience traffic on a daily basis, but we don't, if we're not there 24/7, we don't get to see the realities of what happened. So it was just fun for me to be able to check that out. And to that point, we have as much as possible tried to pair the data with visualizations. So instead of just getting an Excel spreadsheet of some of this data, users can go to our site and check out graphs, maps, pie charts, things like that, that really make it easier to understand what's happening in our city. And so that's been a lot of fun to check out as well. What I find most exciting about this, in addition to the enhancements to city service, is really the ability for open data to drive innovation and to make it possible for kind of a new economy to be created. Just a lot of these apps, for instance, Yelp used some open data from the county to start incorporating scores, health scores, in their Yelp reviews. And so that was only made possible by open data. And so really, that is a limitless area, and we're very excited to see what folks come up with by using Mesa's data.
Ian Linson is the chief of staff to Mesa Mayor John Giles. Ian, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mark.
The military is working on something called implantable neural interfaces, basically a way to tap into the brain. Last month, researchers gathered in Virginia for a meeting convened by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Bradley Greger was there. He's an associate professor in the School of Biological and Health Systems Engineering at ASU.
It's really the idea of building an interface that lets us get information into and out of the human brain. So directly tapping into the kind of the information flow in the human brain.
Meaning that people don't have to talk, they don't have to write, they don't have to type. We can just know what each other is thinking without even saying anything?
Well, yes. Now getting to where we're doing directly brain to brain, that gets quite complicated and sophisticated. This would really be the idea of getting information into and out of the brain using different devices. And the idea for like speech is a good example. One of the earliest projects I was involved with was thinking about people who are paralyzed to the point they're locked in. They can't communicate in any way, but their thoughts are still there. We can go right into those areas of the brain that control speech, look at those signals that are there, those electrical activity that's associated with speech, access that, decode it, and have like a speech synthesizer get their words out.
So how do you do that? I mean, do you have to like physically put something in somebody's body to extract the thoughts?
That right now is the big bottleneck. And because, yes, it requires neurosurgery. So this is not trivial. This is not a consumer product anytime in the near future. Because, yes, it does require right now neurosurgery and placing electrodes, just little tiny, tiny wires on the surface of the brain to get the electrical activity recorded.
How do you test to see if this sort of thing is going to work? I can't imagine you're going to get a ton of volunteers for this.
No. The only people or patients that it makes sense for is people who have an injury or disability who have a loss of some kind, and we're trying to restore function. And I think that's where it will be for the foreseeable future until we get the technology to the point that it becomes less invasive.
How close are you to being able to do this, or how close is anybody to being able to do this?
Well, right now, it's happening right now. There are very exciting projects dealing with people who've lost a limb, so restoring control of or kind of restoring function of the hand using a prosthetic limb that taps directly into peripheral nerves, so the nerves that are in the arm. There's also a project that I'm involved with looking at people who are profoundly blind and going right into the brain to restore vision.
Maybe this is just me, but that seems somewhat different than what you're talking about with sort of extracting thoughts about trying to tap the brain to help somebody move their hand or their arm or be able to see something or sort of visualize than like actually tapping into somebody's brain. One just seems almost more like pragmatic as opposed to philosophical, I guess.
Well, they're both, you've hit on a very deep issue, and there's the whole spectrum here. There's the lowest levels or the more simplest levels where it's just motor control and sensory input. But certainly as you go up in, processing of the brain, you get to thoughts. And that is all fundamentally just neural activity in the brain. And, you can interface with that too. It is still just activity in the brain that you can record using these devices. And that can get to, the level of speech and thought. Now it gets harder and harder because we understand that less and less. We understand vision and movement pretty well. Those are very concrete things. When we start talking philosophy or the morals and ethics of neural interfaces, that's much more sophisticated information to try and pull out.
How big of a stumbling block is it in this research, sort of our lack of understanding and complete understanding of how the brain actually works?
Wow. That's huge. That is certainly fundamental. But what will likely happen, and this is where I think this becomes very exciting as the type of project that should be funded by the government, is that as we develop this technology, it will enable us then to do the studies that help us fundamentally understand the brain itself better. I kind of think of it as like the invention of the microscope. All of a sudden we can see that there are cells and start looking about how they function, how they interact together. We'll be doing that with kind of these neural signals that really underlie human thought and speech. And as we understand them, it'll help us just understand ourselves better as entities, but also then directly understand some of the things that go wrong with the brain.
So you think that by implanting this potentially, it could lead scientists and researchers to figure out sort of what causes Parkinson's, what causes Alzheimer's, and maybe be able to treat or cure those?
Absolutely. There will be huge breakthroughs that will come through this sort of technology because it will be like the microscope or the telescope or the deep space probe will go, oh my goodness, there's a new planet there that we didn't even know about. And when you understand that, you can say, oh, and that's what causes this. And now we can say, okay, now we need this piece of technology or this medicine. That insight will really open up a lot of doors in terms of treatments.
Bradley Greger is an associate professor in the School of Biological and Health Systems Engineering at ASU. We are talking about his work on implantable neural interfaces.
Good Tuesday afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein.
When David Sarr founded Child's Play Theater in the Valley nearly four decades ago, the effort and the productions were definitely modest. An old Chevy transported Sarr and other actors from classroom to perform for students. In recent years, Child's Play has become nationally acclaimed for its creativity and troupe of professional adult actors. And now Sarr is moving into retirement. Before that, though, he joins me. David, what has made Child's Play unique?
We're unusual in that we operate as an ensemble. The company started with a group of artists who created together. That was the purpose for coming together. It wasn't to make an organization. That notion of a number of people working together over time, and as time has gone by, our notion of ensemble has expanded. In the early days, it was just the precious little artists. We realized that there's a whole other world out there that can be a part of what we do, and we're more effective when we include them.
Just because there are other theater groups in the Valley that are known for using child actors, and as you said, you have an ensemble of adults with long resumes. Mm-hmm. How have you been able to keep it at that? Why is it that these particular adults, yourself included, are so interested in that kind of theater?
I guess they've drunk the Kool-Aid. We have a really powerful mission statement that is talks about bringing strikingly original theater to young people because it can improve their lives. And everyone at Child's Play has bought into that mission and is part of making it real. And it's an ongoing job. It's something that we have to rediscover every day with every play we do, with every performance we do. But it's not just the actors anymore. It's a whole organization that's bound around this thing that we believe theater can change children's lives. That's why we're here.
There's been talk about certain things that have survived over the years, you know, whether it's Sesame Street or whether it's some of the Disney films like Toy Story, that they can appeal to the kids and the adults. Has that been part of Child's Play's goal?
Yeah, always.
I
don't want to do good theater. And there's no difference between, you know, big theater for 6-foot people or 4-foot people. They're people. And certainly the issues may be different, but I never want to bore anybody in my audience. And so we all go out of our way to try to create material that is challenging to young people, but also to the adults who accompany them, so that there's the opportunity for dialogue, for conversation. All too often, kids are communicating with screens rather than people. And we offer an opportunity to change that mold for a while at least. Yeah.
Has it impacted how you choose what your season is going to be, the fact that you are trying to do great theater and not just great kids' theater?
The world of the young person today is much different than you and certainly much different than I. There are issues, there are situations and circumstances that they have to deal with that we never would have even dreamed of. And so the whole material basis of, you know, what might children's theater involve or look at is expanded. It's gone way beyond asking which way did the witch grow, you know, into really important ideas for young people.
Do you get a different reaction from a child today than you did 20 years ago? Or if it's good, do they react the same way as they always did?
The reaction is there. It is immediate. It is honest. And you know exactly where you're at. How they actually show that might be different, slightly different ways. But the impulse of the response remains the same, and it comes from a pure place in childhood.
David Sarr, he's retiring from his role as artistic director for Child's Play Theater after 39 years. And later this month, Sarr will receive the 2016 Shelley Award at the annual Governor's Arts Awards for helping advance arts in Arizona.
The spotlight is on Major League Baseball's spring training here in the Valley, but the focus isn't any less intense for young hopefuls at MLB's academies in places like the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, and Venezuela. But what happens to the vast majority of young academy players who don't get signed to a pro contract? From the Fronteras desk, KJZZ's Lorne Madelon reports from Colombia about a goal many players have, and it's not necessarily to make it to the big leagues.
Listen to the sound of a dream.
Okay, corriendo, team, corriendo, corriendo. Vamos.
We're at Estadio Tomás Arrieta, home of the Edgar Renteria Baseball Academy in the port city of Barranquilla.
Hey.
It's on Colombia's Caribbean coast. Renteria is an idol here. He hit a World Series winning run in 1997 and was series MVP in 2010.
Soy, vamos, arriba, vamos!
Let's get going, Coach Javier Pajaro says to his team of teenaged prospects. The players all want to be another Edgar Renteria. But St. Louis Cardinals scout here, Carlos Balcazar, says something else matters more.
Well, the goal is first teaching discipline to the kids to be better men.
Balcazar says that's critical given so few Latin American players will make the big leagues.
I think that's the whole thing about the sport, being a team sport, learning how to respect your opponent, your teammates.
Colombia is not a crucible of talent like the Dominican Republic or Venezuela. In the Dominican Republic, MLB teams run their own academies, high-intensity training centers designed to spawn the next generation of Latin America's best players. In Venezuela, baseball academies are withering as the country skates close to the edge of economic and political collapse. In the academies, teams sign, pay, and train prospects. There's no requirement to finish high school because only players in MLB's draft, that is, players from Canada, the U.S., and Puerto Rico, must be high school graduates. Meet Colombian prospect 17-year-old pitcher Sebastian Herrera.
Baseball is everything to me. I play Saturdays, Sundays. This is my life.
But Herrera says he's not focused on a pro career.
I want to win a scholarship in a United States university. That's it.
A study by the nonprofit Council of the Americas in New York says between 2 and 3% of Latin American players make it to the big leagues. In 2000, MLB sent a team of investigators to the Dominican Republic to report on the education programs of major league teams there.
There's a huge deficit in providing educational opportunities for these prospects.
Charles Farrell was one of the MLB investigators. He didn't like what he saw and still doesn't. He's a former Washington Post reporter and now runs a nonprofit academy in the Dominican Republic that mandates high school graduation for its students. We spoke to him from his office in the capital of Santo Domingo.
It's sort of understandable. Major League Baseball is not in the business of education, so education will never be a priority. Developing the next David Ortiz is the priority.
Two MLB teams have a high school education program. The Pittsburgh Pirates pay for high school until the end of the year that a prospect is released. But the Arizona Diamondbacks are the only MLB team that pays for a high school education all the way, even when the team drops a prospect from its academy. Arizona Diamondbacks Senior Vice President Josh Rawich was on hand for the prospects game in Colombia.
One of the things we try to do is actually educate these guys, teach them English, have them learn about life, not just about baseball. The best organizations realize that they are actually raising men, not just ball players, and that's something that I think we take very seriously, the Diamondbacks.
And remember Colombian prospect Sebastian Herrera? Well, here's Rawich on that.
It's neat to hear that a kid already is thinking that way at 17, and that a college scholarship is to him. That's his big leagues. That's a pretty neat thing to see.
Five other teams have a pilot program that began last year. An astounding statistic given the teams spend around $100 million each year operating baseball academies. Baseball historian Bob Ruck is at the University of Pittsburgh.
The efforts are better than they were in the past, but they're scattershot, they're uneven.
Ruck is the author of The Tropic of Baseball, Baseball in the Dominican Republic.
Because a lot of them will crash and burn in baseball before they hit 20 or 21. And they've got little left to fall back upon.
Concéntrate, vamos, busca la bola en la zona, bueno swing.
Back in Colombia, players do nurture dreams of the big leagues, of course, but they're using their hometown patch of grass and dirt to try and make it to a U.S. college. Lauren Madelon, KJZZ News, Barranquilla, Colombia.
You've seen it if you've ever been to a natural history museum, animals that are no longer living but made to look like they are. Once confined behind the glass of a museum or curiosity shop, taxidermy is evolving as an interactive art form. The show's Annika Klein has more.
I'll do an elephant or a mouse, anything in between. Anything has to do with taxidermy.
Doug James has more than your average tools in his backyard shed.
This is my bird box.
The wooden walls are lined with fish and one very expressive javelina. A pair of horns sits on the table. It has a very distinct smell.
What is that?
Probably fiberglass and stain. I just got done doing these.
He picks up the horns and, surprise, they're fake. But they're painted to look real, so he can put them onto a taxidermy of a bighorn sheep. James says these days, the lines are blurring between fake and real, art and animal. Taxidermists are trying new things because tastes are changing. And so is the clientele.
There's a lot of younger people, especially that are interested in a lot of women. And I know that's something that's new to the field.
Mason Conway owns a shop called Curious Nature, where he sells taxidermy and also items like a beaver jaw necklace and alligator foot keychains. He says his customers want more than the stereotypical deer head mounted on a wood panel. And the shop offers taxidermy classes. In the next one, students will work with rats.
So they'll learn how to skin and prepare the skin and do the sculpting and making of the forms afterwards. You start with an animal and you're leaving with a completed piece.
Conway says some people like to dress them up or decorate them even. It's not the kind of thing you find in a taxidermy catalog. But that's what excites Doug James, who will be teaching their next class.
I could never just mount deer heads all day long, day after day after day. I just couldn't do it. I mean, some of the stuff that the new people are doing would drive the older people crazy. But I think it's neat.
That's why he's mounting his example rats in a model car. He calls it a rat rod. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
The next taxidermy class at Curious Nature is April 2nd. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.